to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Hey, everybody. It's Nikki Nellis with Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. And you just have the foodie today. My husband, David Nellis, is out and about and doing his thing. And I'm thinking that it should just be Industry Night with me, Nikki Nellis. I think it's going to be a much more entertaining show. So anyway, we're really excited about what we're going to be talking about today. The Michelin Guide is coming out. And with it comes a whole host of new starred restaurants and new bib gourmands. And lucky me, I'm going to be talking to Michael Ellis. He's the international director of the Michelin Guide. He's going to give us the 411 on everything going on with Michelin and why it's so important to the dining scene in D.C. And then later in the show, I'm talking with Kyle McKinney. I said that right?
Kylie, but yeah.
Kylie. Oh, Kylie McGinney. Sorry, I know your name. Kylie is, she is Mission Michelin. She has this fabulous Instagram page and blog where she talks about her dining around the DC scene using Michelin as her guide. And we're going to get really into her eating habits around the city. But first, let me get Michael Ellis on the phone. Michael, are you there?
I am indeed. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Excellent. Thanks so much.
Excellent. Well, it's time for our annual interview. I get to interview once a year. I feel very lucky about that.
My pleasure.
Okay. Well, so let's talk first for those people who are living under a rock. The guide. What is the guide? Tell us about the Michelin Guide and why it is such a force in the dining world.
Sure. I think the Michelin Guide today is really visible around the world because of our history, our legacy. We were founded in France in 1900, so 118 years ago. We were originally founded by the Michelin brothers, who were invented the inflatable automobile tire. And in order to get people to buy tires, they realized that people had to drive back in a time when there was only a few thousand cars in all of France. So they came up with the Michelin Guide to tell drivers where to buy gasoline because there was no gas stations, where to get their cars fixed because there were no garages, and where to sleep and where to eat. And over the years, our readers recognized the value of the restaurant and hotel recommendations, and the Michelin Guide is now morphed into what we consider the leading barometer around the world for fine dining, and we currently have a presence in over 30 countries around the world.
But there was a huge shift at some point in how the guide came together. I remember as a child, my mom having a guide, you know, when we went on long car trips. And at what point did it become this more elitist guide for dining with starred restaurants and the bib gourmands? Like, how did it evolve over time?
We still like to emphasize the fact that the stars, which were invented in 1936, I think that was really when the recognition for the restaurant world became important with the creation of 1, 2, and 3 stars. But the stars, although it's the most visible part of the iceberg, really only represent between 10% and 15% of a given selection. So we also have the bib gourmands, which is great food for an attractive price. And we have the restaurants that have the Michelin plate, and those are 70% of more or less of the restaurants. And that's, you know, we're not a phone book, so just being in the Michelin Guide is a sign of good food. But I think that really what has happened over the last, say, 25 to 30 years is food has become really a national obsession, not just in the United States, but around the world. Everywhere I go around the world, I think food has become part of the narrative of people's lives. And people have, I think, never been more interested in food. And I think Michelin has become kind of the go-to guide to find really great restaurants.
Well, I think you've hit a very good point. I mean, the last 30 years has seen a real growth in the dining world overall, whereas some areas, like D.C. is such a great example, there were certainly good restaurants in D.C. 30 years ago. I mean, we had Jean-Louis and Roberta Donna, but, you know, we just didn't have the breadth and depth of restaurants like we do now. And I think you're finding that not just here in D.C., but in smaller metropolitan cities in the United States and around the world. And a lot of people are clamoring for and deserve that kind of attention. How has the judging of the guide kept up with all that?
We really have used the exact same system we have for the last century. So I think our successes and our longevity are based on two different things. The first is the Michelin inspector. And the job of a Michelin inspector is, to my knowledge, unique in the world, in that the Michelin inspector is a food expert. Most of them have gone to cooking school or have worked in restaurants. They have to have the unique ability to taste, just like we have with called noses in the perfume business, who have a great ability to smell. Our Michelin inspectors have to have the right number of taste buds on the right place on their tongue.
Do you consider them super tasters?
We do. I think that we have not been able to quantify it scientifically, but it is physiologically true that some people have a higher ability to taste than others, and that's certainly when we take our inspectors out, our candidates, before we hire them. We do take them to a restaurant with a Michelin inspector and have them eat the same thing and ask the candidates to write about it the way the inspector would. And the inspectors also are anonymous. That's very important for us. When an inspector goes into a restaurant, he or she can't be recognized because as the visible face for Michelin, I can confirm that if you are recognized, you get different treatment and different food. And
that goes without saying. Sometimes it's a good thing and sometimes it's a bad thing, getting recognized,
right?
And
that's exactly, absolutely. I eat a lot of cold food because I think they're fussing over it in the kitchen so much before they take it out.
Right, or sometimes they just send out an abundance of food where you can't possibly enjoy all of it.
Absolutely. The chef wants you to try everything.
Of course.
That's another pearl of this job. And we also pay, and this is also very important, Michelin always pay our bills. So it's these anonymous food experts eating out twice a day, 5 days a week, and paying their bills that is our method. And then it's the method of the methodology, the actual selection criteria that we use to judge a meal, and that is the same in New York as it is in Washington or Paris or London or Tokyo or Rio de Janeiro. It's always the same method, and that is, first of all, the inspectors look for the quality of the ingredients, the product. All good food starts with good product. Then they look at the mastery of cooking technique. Things need to be perfectly cooked, not undercooked or overcooked. And, for example, a piece of fish has probably a 30-second window or so when it's perfectly cooked. Before that, it's undercooked. After that, it's overcooked. So that's extremely important.
Mm-hmm.
Next, the inspector will look for harmony and equilibrium in the flavors. Are things balanced? Is it not too salty or too sweet or too acidic, or there's too much herbs or too much flavoring, or is the sauce too boiled down? Or there's all these different things that make it important that there has to be complete harmony in what we're eating. And finally, we look for consistency over time. So whether the meal is being had in February, June, or November, the quality is there, or consistency throughout the menu. So first course, main course, dessert, vegetables, fruit, meat, everything should be of the same level of quality. So it's those unique Michelin inspectors applying those five criteria that I think have been the formula for our success for over a century.
Well, so how do they apply those concepts? I mean, I guess it matters in all restaurants, but as the dining scene changes drastically with fewer and fewer upscale fine dining restaurants and more fast casual restaurants and more, it's more casual dining. Restaurants are serving really good quality food, but in a much less formal atmosphere. How does Michelin deal with that?
Well, we've always been about the food. The stars are always awarded, and just being in the selection is always based upon what's in the plate.
So service and atmosphere are not priorities in the judging?
They are reflected in the guide. It's what we call the knife and fork symbols that we use.
Mm-hmm.
No longer use those in the United States. That was something we've used in France traditionally and in Europe. So we had a crossed knife and a fork. If you look at the Guide to France, for example, you have a knife and a fork that are crossed, and you can have one, two, three, four, or five of them, and they can be red or black. So it was kind of confusing.
It sounds like a lot of figuring out.
It is a lot of figuring out, but this also goes back to the 1930s and 40s or 50s when restaurants were it was to illustrate the comfort of a restaurant. Back then, it was, you know, how thick were the cushions on the seat? You know, what kind of linen was on the table? What kind of is it Baccarat crystal for the glassware, the stemware? Is it Christofle silverware?
Sure.
So those are the type of things that back, you know, way back when people looked for. That was what a luxurious restaurant was based upon, a luxurious comfort level. And that is completely different today. You can have some of the finest restaurants in the world have extremely simple settings. Certainly if you look at Japan, where you can have three-star restaurants in Tokyo or Kyoto or Osaka that are completely bare. They're just, it's just blonde wood everywhere with nothing. It's just very, a very, very zen type atmosphere. So that's something that's, I think, been a recent phenomenon. So we are still just focused on the food, and the attribution of stars is always just based upon those five criteria.
Interesting, because I think a lot of people, when they go through the guide, think that atmosphere and service goes hand in hand with excellent
food.
And sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. I wanted to ask, how important is it for the guide to be diverse? Is that a priority when you're putting the guide together? I mean, in these times, you know, there's the Me Too movement, you know, James Beard Foundation is saying, you know, we're going to judge people differently now because we're going to judge chefs by how they act, not just by what they put on the plate. And diversity is very important. We're looking to see more women chefs. We're looking to see more people of color. Is that important to Michelin?
Sure, it's important to us, but we won't integrate it into our judging of the food. I mean, we've always been about the food. We certainly encourage and applaud diversity. We love to see, obviously, women chefs are going into the kitchen and anybody. So we're certainly, that's, you know, we're members of society, so we obviously applaud that, but that's not something that we will incorporate into the judging of the food.
Okay. And what about, and I don't want to harp on this, but the Me Too movement, you know, with some of these chefs who may have won stars in the past that are getting called out for inappropriate behavior, does that affect their ability to maintain a star or maintain being in the guide?
But we think that that's something that the public, you know, if it's obviously, if it's something that's so egregious, it's, you know, it's the court system to take that up.
Mm-hmm.
If not, it's the public. I mean, the diners need to vote with their feet. If a diner does not want
to... Or their fork.
I mean, you know, I think that that's something that, you know, that's incumbent upon each individual to go to the restaurant that they think is in correspondence to what they are expecting. But certainly we're looking at, that's the court of, you know, public opinion. We are looking just as what's on the plate.
Got it. And let's talk about the Bib Gourmand, because it is a newer award. And I'd love for people to have a better understanding of how that gets applied, because in D.C., there's 19 new awards this year.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's really something that it's been around for, actually in its current state, for 20 years now. It was invented, 21 years, it was invented in 1997. But we've always had a symbol in the guide since the 50s for restaurants that have particularly good food at a great price. We think that it's a great opportunity for us to recognize those kitchens that are able to serve outstanding food at an attractive price. And I think the fact that we're able to find 19 new ones in D.C. is, to my recollection, and I've been here doing this for 7 years now, it is a record for any individual city in the U.S. to have 19 new Bib Gourmands in a given year. So I think it's a tribute to just how good and exciting and dynamic the dining scene in D.C. has become over the years.
Well, we also just got our third star. It's our first time in the D.C. market. It's very exciting. It goes to the Inn at Little Washington for Patrick O'Connell. I'm sure there's some two-star restaurants that are going to be thrilled for him, but also not so thrilled for themselves. What goes into that third star for Patrick? I mean... We're diners of the Inn at Little Washington. I've known Patrick for years, but it's been a goal of his. It was so important for Michelin to be here in the D.C. market to him. You know, he sees you as the epitome. It was the last, like, diamond that he needed in his crown, you know?
Yeah. I think that what Patrick has done is amazing. Of course, I've been familiar with the Inn at Little Washington, you know, he's been around for decades, 40 years now.
Yes.
And I think what we find in Patrick was inspired when he was a young man, as I was when I was visiting France, 40 odd years ago as well. I mean, you found something, these Relais Chateaus, these incredible historic places that had incredible food, incredible lodging, and it was something that you just didn't find back then in the United States.
No.
I think that you have an epiphany when you see that, and it inspired Patrick. I trained as a chef in France back in the late 70s, but decided to do something else with my life. But Patrick went ahead and lived his dream, and I think in his magnificent obsession, as he calls it. And he was really able to recreate one of these provincial, luxurious lodging and dining establishments in a small town in Virginia, in rural Virginia, which was just is amazing. And he was able to bring that to an incredible level. And when the first guide came out, we were there, he got 2 stars right off the bat. He's producing exquisite, modern personal interpretations of the great French classical cuisine. We went a number of times every year, and we shared with Patrick what our inspectors found. And I said we sent U.S. inspectors, but also European inspectors, French inspectors as well. And we shared what the inspectors found with Patrick, and I think he took that to heart and was able to really bring his level of cooking up to a new heights and really express emotion. The third Michelin star it's got to be an emotional experience. It's something you should be eating dishes that you've never tasted before. It should be a unique experience. You know, we call it the wow factor, where you say, "Wow, I've never."
Well, I'm thinking of like when Sally met Harry, kind of factor, right? Like it's supposed to take you to another level.
Yes, absolutely. I'll have what she's having.
Exactly. Very good. mentioned something that's really fascinating to me. So can restaurants communicate with you and say, I want to do better. We want to do better. What do we need to do? I didn't know that I didn't know it was an option. I don't know if restaurants know that that's an option.
No, that's a recent option. And I think that that's something that I have taken on board as in under my activity here as being head of the Michelin Guides. I thought it was important for us to do that because there's a lot of misconceptions, a lot of mystery, not necessarily true, that surrounds the Michelin Guide. And I think it's important that we need to have, you know, in this day and age, we need to have dialogue, we need to have communications with the restaurants. We don't tell chefs what to do or how to run their restaurants or what they need to do to get a Michelin star, but I think it's important that we share with them if they want to see what did the inspector find? How did he find the ingredients? How did he find the cooking technique? Were things overcooked or undercooked? How did the inspector find the harmony and the balance and the flavors? So I think that's important for us. The message and the only message that we have been giving to chefs for years now is that objective number one has got to be to cook for your customers. Make sure your restaurant is filled with happy clients who want to come back. Make sure your restaurant is successful. And if you do that well, Michelin will come and find you. But we do think, I think, if for those restaurants who do want to pursue Michelin stars for whatever reason, and certainly I worked in a 1-star Michelin restaurant many years ago, and it's you get a great pride from that. You feel like you're a member of an exclusive club, and the restaurant, you know, it's kind of like the Olympics of cooking. It's great to have most chefs are, in my experience, part athlete and part artist.
I think some of them think they're part rock star too. So,
that's kind of the celebrity culture that has evolved over the last few years. When I was working in a kitchen years ago, it was the owner that was a celebrity. We were just a hired help. Mm-hmm. Being a chef back then was like being a carpenter or a mason. I mean, you were the hired help. Now the chefs have become rock stars, which is, I think, interesting. It's changed things quite a bit, but that just shows that, and that's around the world, and I think that just shows how important dining and eating has become to people around the world, and I think that's why the Michelin Guide has also been able to we've been the unique Michelin spotlight that is shown on a restaurant that gets a Michelin star, 1, 2, or 3 stars. It shines around the world. So I know from just experience, a third Michelin star, a second or third Michelin star opens up your restaurant to people coming in from Brazil or Tokyo or Taiwan or Moscow. So what they call gastro tourists now, and this is why a lot of the tourist boards are chasing.
I got one in studio. I have a girl. I got somebody in studio. This is what she does.
True story. Yeah.
Well, of course. Well, who I met last night, I believe.
Yes, you did. You met her last night.
Hello.
I signed her guide. Yeah. Well, we love to meet people like Kylie because, and there's a lot of them out there. They're really They're really obsessed. In fact, one guy, Englishman, is his claim to fame is he's eaten in every single Michelin 3-star restaurant on the planet. You know, he's made a career out of that. So we think that's great.
Of course, I think that's great. I mean, it helps support your brand. What I think is interesting is that in these times, the food world is exploding. It's fabulous. I mean, it's my business too, so I totally appreciate that. But what's interesting about the guide specifically and these followers of the guide, your devotees, is that, you know, with TripAdvisor and Yelp, I mean, you have all these other services that really, in my opinion, don't really celebrate food, even though they're from a business perspective, they could be very valuable. But, you know, you have all these places where people can criticize or complain or write a good review. And it's interesting that Michelin has been able to rise above that and not enter those fields.
Well, I think that, you know, in this now with the digital revolution in full swing, the ability to have information out there, I mean, in this fog of opinions, you know, this user-generated content, you know, you have to ask yourself, well, gosh, the person who's leaving this restaurant critique on Yelp or TripAdvisor or whatever it is, does this person know how to eat? You know, did this person really actually have that meal? Because there are reviews given of restaurants that the person never even went there. You see Instagram photos of pick a food taken in that the restaurant doesn't serve. So, you know, does this person know how to eat? How does this person... you know, does this person have the same taste that I do? So in this fog of information, in this fog of critiques, you know, there's got to be some sort of a North Star or a gold standard out there. And I think people can look at the Michelin Guide. They'll maybe look at different sources of information, different reviews, and say, oh, well, let's go see what Michelin says. And we're kind of like the ultimate arbiter, and we're more than happy to play that role.
Well, I think that makes a lot of sense. So now the book will be available as of September 17th, right?
That's correct.
Okay. And people can get that everywhere. If there's one thing that you would really like people to know about the Michelin Guide, I'd like some parting words on why you think today, or any day, why it's so important to open up that book and find something new in there.
I think that, you know, the Michelin Guide, just we have something for everybody. And, you know, we're not just about fine dining. We're about, if you want to pick, you know, a fine dining restaurant, a Michelin-starred restaurant that you want to go to, if you want to have a luxurious, comfortable atmosphere, if you want to have a fun, boisterous meal, if you want to have a family meal, you want to go out and celebrate an anniversary, you want to have great Thai food, you want to have a great burger, a great pizza, if you want to have, really, I think that we have something for everybody, and I think it's based in our ability to be about as objective as possible for something that is inherently subjective. We've been able to do that over the last century, and I think we are really happy and pleased to be able to steer people to the restaurants that they want to go to, and we're going to keep doing that for, I think, many, many years to come.
Well, for the D.C. market, it is certainly an accolade, and we love having Michelin here. The last question I want to ask you, I meant to ask you this before, is when it comes to finding the restaurants in the D.C. market, because you have, how many restaurants are in the book this year?
About 130.
130. So last year was 119, was it? 100-ish?
Right.
Okay, so 130. Yeah. What are the parameters to bring in, to go to new restaurants? Like, do you give the secret judges a list, or are they supposed to find them on their own? How many restaurants do they go to?
Well, the inspectors, that's one of the key parts of being an inspector is their ability to be detectives. Mm-hmm. So when we send the inspection, you know, we use different inspectors, different nationalities here to come to the United States, both American inspectors, European and Asian inspectors, so we mix it up. Each inspector is incumbent. They've got to go, and they've using, you know, existing sources of information, whether it's the local media, the digital media, other guidebooks, other restaurant critiques. We collate all that, look at all that. But then we go and do the real detective work, which means going out to a restaurant, for example, and asking the wait staff or the chef, where do they go when they're off duty? That's one of the, you know, or going into even a butcher shop or a bakery and asking the people there, you know, I'm in town for a few days, where can I go and get a good meal around here? And I think that human intelligence, that local knowledge, especially for people who work in the hospitality business, they tend to go to the places that, those great places that might not be on the radar. So our ability to do that is very important. And we try to give the best of a snapshot as we can of the current culinary scene in a given city. And our inspectors, that's a big part of their jobs.
Well, I want to thank you so much for taking some time to talk with us today. We're very excited about the new Michelin Guide, which will be available on September 17th with its new 3-star award for the Inn at Little Washington. Michael Ellis, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you. So my much. Pleasure.
We'll see you tonight. This is Nikki Nellis. I'm here on Industry Night at the gorgeous Line Hotel. I'm going to take a little break. When we get back, we're going to dive in deep with our real Michelin devotee. We'll be back in just a sec.
By Morris today. We'll be right back.
Hey, everybody, it's Nikki Nellis, Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. I am beastless for a change, and I think I'm just changing the show. I think it should just be Industry Night with me, Nikki Nellis. I'm really excited. We just had an incredible interview with Michael Ellis. He's the International Director of the Michelin Guide. And we really got the 411 on the new guide being dropped next week, but the announcement today Patrick O'Connell from the Inn at Little Washington did get his 3 stars, but we're going to dive in deep to the other starred restaurants and Bib Gourmands. I'm really fortunate today because I have become friendly with Kylie McKinney, who its name I mispronounced at the beginning of the show. Thank you so much. She began eating her way through the Michelin Guide. And this is an amazing story. And now she writes about it and Instagrams about it. And you can follow her at Mission Michelin. And hi, thanks
Hello.
For joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
So I have to ask, I mean, I kind of know the answer, but I'd like everybody else to hear it. How did you start eating your way through the DC Michelin Guide? And what did that entail?
So I used to live on U Street. I was on 16th and U. I was kind of right in the heart of everything. And then I got married, I had kids, I moved to the suburbs. And so for 5 years, I was living out in the burbs, kind of disconnected from the DC restaurant scene. And one day I was at work and I was at lunch and my friends started talking about DC restaurants. And for like 20 minutes, they were talking about all these new restaurants they had been to, places they have gone. I didn't know a single restaurant they were talking about. And I felt so, I don't want to say embarrassed, but I was like, how am I this out of the loop? So I'm a researcher by trade, so I decided, you know what, I'm going to do my research. I am going to systematically just reacquaint myself with DC restaurants. So I decided that I needed a list, and that's how I would just check off every restaurant on the list. So at first I was going to make my own list, but that was really hard. I didn't even know what I didn't know. So I was kind of in search of a list. And wouldn't you know, a week later, I go to a girlfriend's baby shower, and there on her coffee table is the Michelin Guide. So I start thumbing through it, and I originally thought it was just the starred restaurants. I didn't know it was all the Michelin plate, the Bib Gourmand. And so all of a sudden I see, you know, over 100 restaurants, and I was like, you know what? This is my list. This is perfect. And then a week later, I started in December of 2016. Purple Patch was my first restaurant. And honestly,
now Purple Patch is not a starred restaurant. It's just a
Michelin plate.
Michelin plate. And for people who may be just tuning in, there are starred restaurants. There are Bib Gourmands. And then there are Michelin plates. And Michelin plates, not everybody gets into the guide, right?
Not at all, yeah.
So, because the new one coming out has 130 restaurants. There's well over 130 restaurants in the D.C. market.
Sure.
So which guide did you start with?
So I started with the 2017 guide. It was the first year that the Michelin guide had come out. What is so funny is I was so out of touch, I didn't even know like all the fanfare about it. I was like, D.C. has a Michelin guide? When I saw it at my friend's. So.
Well, it's interesting that you chose to go with the Michelin guide. I mean, maybe it was just right place, right time, instead of doing Tom Sietsema's Top 50 or the Washingtonian's 100. I mean, it's not like there aren't other lists.
Agreed. I think there was some familiarity with the Michelin brand in general. I had heard of it before, and I think that probably piqued my interest. But agreed, there are lots of other lists, and I'm so happy this is the one I landed on.
No, you landed on a good one. So how did you start your process?
So I honestly... I would do lunches in concentric circles from my office. That was one way. I kind of went to restaurants I was very excited about at first. So kind of the Tillip Goats, Rose's Luxury. I actually circled back to a lot of those because now I feel like I'm a much different diner than I was 2 years ago.
Well, how has your dining changed? I mean, you made your way through the book.
Mm-hmm.
So are you starting up again? What are you doing?
Yes. So just from the Bib Gourmands alone, I have 12 new restaurants that I need to go to.
Okay.
And that doesn't include the new stars or the new Michelin plate restaurants. So
okay.
Yes.
So there's a lot more dining to do.
Yes.
But how did you, when at first you were just going because you wanted to stay in the know of restaurants, but now that has obviously changed. So how has that changed for you?
I think that now I want to... I think in some ways I like to go to, sometimes I want to go back to restaurants that I had already been to, so when I was doing, just trying to check off every restaurant sort of, I literally never went to the same restaurant twice. I didn't want to, I wanted to always be making progress sort of. And now I'm much more likely to go back, to experience things again, to go, either, oh, this place has a new chef and I want to try it again. They're doing a special event and I want to try
it again.
So
you're a more educated diner.
Yes, I would say that that's
You have a better understanding of what's going on at these restaurants.
Yes, and I get really excited when they're doing new things, when a new menu comes out or when they were doing the duck press at Bresca, that kind of thing. I'm doing those kinds of things, whereas before I would have been like, no, I can't go back to that restaurant. We have to,
Right. I have a plan.
Yes.
I have to stick to. So as you were sticking to your initial plan when you first started, what were some of the things you were discovering?
Well, one of the things I discovered is how important, it's so funny that Michael Ellis was saying that kind of atmosphere and service aren't part of the criteria.
Aren't you shocked?
Yes.
I am shocked.
Because the number one thing I learned about this in this journey, in this mission, if you will, is how important that is to me. I have had experiences where I have had fantastic service and so food and left and been like, that was transformative, that was amazing,
like I'm going back.
Yes. And then I've had experiences where the food was flawless and the service was a little off and I said, I just didn't feel comfortable and I don't want to go there again.
Right. I feel exactly the same way. I mean, I think I eat an awful lot and I dine, up and down I dine everywhere I go, obviously, but in the DC market quite a bit, and I find that it's not that service has to be French service or super formal. It just has to be good.
Yes.
I mean, the bar is not that high for me personally. It just needs to be consistent and good and thoughtful and aware and knowledgeable for
yes,
it to be
agreed. And
good.
I think an interesting example of that would be a place like Minibar, where it has, everyone's in a kitchen table, basically. So it's not kind of
okay,
like...
Okay, for people who haven't, because not everybody has had the Minibar experience, why don't you give a little 411 on
it? So Minibar is Jose Andreas's two-star restaurant. It's basically everyone's sitting at this counter, and the restaurant is the kitchen. Mm-hmm. There is no kind of separate kitchen. All the chefs are there. It's the chef serving you. And so... that's a very different experience than kind of a white tablecloth traditional French restaurant.
Also, I mean, it was one of Jose Andre's first forays into the molecular gastronomy side of cooking when he launched that 16 years ago. So there's been, there's been a lot of advances in that kind of cooking in the last 16 years, but he was definitely at the forefront of it. So you are going to have... if you go to Minibar, you're going to have actually what Michael Ellis said earlier. You're going to have things that you're not going to have anywhere else,
exactly.
Right? You're
going to
eat a little sphere that looks like, a bit of jelly, but it's an olive. Everything, there's so much trompe l'oeil that you really don't know what you're getting when you put it in your mouth, or the spritz of smoke, or, so they do a lot of things. Smell this first, then eat this. It's a multi-sensory experience.
Exactly. And for me, the service there is just it's beyond compare. I just think that they do go above and beyond, and it's so amazing.
Well, let's talk about the list a little bit. You have been to the Little Washington.
I have indeed.
What do you think about it getting 3 stars?
Well, I actually finished my mission at the Inn at Little Washington, so it was the 110th restaurant that I went to. I called it the Finn Alley. Additionally,
you're very punny.
Yes.
Very good.
Additionally, it was my birthday too, so it was really exciting. I think that, you know, there are definitions for, I don't know them off the top of my head, but for 1, 2, and 3 stars. And the 3-star is like worth a special trip. And by default, if you're driving out to, being a Little Washington, you're kind of doing that. So I
don't want to take away anything from Patrick O'Connell, but to me personally, he doesn't need a star to tell me that that restaurant is amazing.
Oh, I agree.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, you walk in, just walk into the place and it's so special. Everything about the inn is fabulous.
He did a great thing at the Smithsonian where it was like dining as theater or something.
Yes.
Oh, it was such a good event because he basically talked about what people need from dining. And he talked much about the experience. And you can tell that the experience is as important, if not more so, than the food to him, based on the things that he was saying. And
well,
was
he's
really...
also a Relais Chateau property, and the requirements for Relais Chateau are pretty stringent, you know, so you have that as well as the guide, both of which are very important to him. Getting his Relais Chateau status was very important to him as well, with good reason. I mean, it has an impeccable reputation all around the world. I mean, there are people who look to stay specifically at Relais Chateau properties. I mean, I'm definitely one of them. I love them. They're fabulous.
That's awesome.
So with your mission, once you finish the book, now what? Like, how do you grow?
So,
and how do people, and what are you doing with it? Talk, like, are you writing about it? I know you Instagram, but how are you sharing your experience?
I primarily through Instagram. I was blogging religiously, but then honestly, August last year, I went to like 10 restaurants in a week, and I just was like, I can't do this. I can't write about these. And also, the more I wrote about them and the more into it I got, the longer it would take me because I wanted it to be just perfect. And I got so excited about all these aspects. So the blog has kind of fallen by the wayside compared to Instagram, I would say. Mm-hmm. I think that, so one, the 2019 guide is out. So there's lots of stuff that I'm going to be doing there. Two, I'm, you know, in this past year, I went to San Francisco, Chicago, and New York, which are all the other 3 Michelin cities in the United States. I have also been traveling internationally, and whenever I do so, I buy my Michelin guide. I'm going to Barcelona in a month, so I feel like, you know, Mission Michelin's going international a bit. But first and foremost, the goal of this was to reacquaint myself with the D.C. dining scene. So even if there were no Michelin guide in D.C., you know, the D.C. dining scene is constantly evolving.
Mm-hmm.
New restaurants are opening, chefs are moving around, they're doing these special things or special events. So I feel like that will continue, just, you know.
Because you love it.
Yes, exactly. I'll be a part of it while it evolves. Long term, I would love more than anything else to be, they don't have these, but I want to be like a brand ambassador for Michelin. So the World's 50 Best is a similar kind of organization, and they have these taste hunters. And I'd love to do something like that for Michelin. So basically kind of like promote the brand, increase awareness. Because like you said, a lot of people don't know. They know about the stars. They don't know about the Bib Gourmand. They don't know what cities have
Michelin
guides.
Well, they also, I think a lot of people don't understand that if you are in the Michelin guide, actually, I know restaurants that don't understand that being in the Michelin guide that's an accolade in and of itself. That getting in, just because you don't have a star doesn't mean you're not in there.
Exactly.
And it's very important. And I know several restaurants who are in the guide who don't recognize what an accolade that is.
Yes, I agree 100%.
Now, for the layperson, how do you recommend them using the Michelin guide?
I think that using it as kind of a sign of quality is helpful. So if you're deciding between 2 restaurants and you see that this one's Michelin recommended, as Michael said, you have, you know, a professional anonymous inspector who has inspected that restaurant. So that means something.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, I mean, for me, obviously, I went through every single restaurant. I think it's really good when you are visiting somewhere, using it sort of as an organizing principle, a first stop. So I will buy a Michelin guide if I'm going to a city, and I'll look at what restaurants are starred, what restaurants are recommended. And like, maybe I won't exclusively go to those, but it's a good kind of starting point.
Okay. And do you do other research or do you stick to the guide?
I do other research. I would say I use World's 50 Best. I'll look at blogs and cities are really helpful. I found this amazing restaurant in Lisbon called Punto Final that's under a bridge that's the most gorgeous vista I've ever seen that I found on some random blog. So I definitely will try to triangulate. I also will watch No Reservations or Parts Unknown. That's usually like a good starting place.
Absolutely. And I do think it's important to use multiple sources. Mm-hmm. And what I wanted to ask was, were there times that you used the guide where you were like, no, absolutely not. I don't know what they're talking about. This is not good. This is not, I don't like it. Or, oh my God, I can't believe this doesn't have more. Like, this is amazing. Why isn't this more?
I could see being surprised that this doesn't have more. I feel like the one stars in Europe are a little different than they are here, in the sense that they're much more kind of kinship and métier, as opposed to like Tail Up Goat and Rose's Luxury.
Right.
They're very formal. Probably not exclusively, but having just gone to Portugal, they are very formal. They're very elegant.
Is everybody going to Portugal right
now? I know.
My sister was there this summer. My girlfriend went there this summer. Two of my other friends went there this summer. It is like, it's like everybody just up and went to Portugal.
Also, everyone should go to Portugal. It's amazing.
Okay. It's on my list.
Yeah. So I just feel like those are really fancy. And in the United States, I often wonder, like, would that have two stars? But I know, I don't think there's any that I've been to where I'm like, this is terrible. Also, I found that, like, in Lisbon, for instance, I felt like there were many fewer restaurants in the guide. So I think I went to almost all the starred restaurants, or maybe all minus one. So I feel like there's less of a chance maybe.
Well,
for
one
error.
Of the things we didn't get into with Michael Ellis from Michelin today, I actually discussed it with him last year, was that it's D.C. specific. So it's only in D.C.
Yes.
except the Inn at Little Washington. And there's a lot of people who are complaining, like, wait a second. It's not in D.C. It's 90 minutes away. Why does that get preference when there are restaurants on the way out there?
Yes.
That could certainly be Bib Gourmand's, or maybe, I don't know, a star or something like that. But and in Europe, you don't see it as restrictive because there are amazing restaurants, just like the Inn at Little Washington, in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, it's more of country-based in Europe, whereas here it's city-based.
And, right.
Yes, I agree 100%. I would love for it to be like regional or something like that, or even just going to the D.C. suburbs. So I've heard them, Michelin, talk about the fact that they just didn't have the capacity to send the inspectors to Maryland and Virginia, and I think it's a shame because there are awesome restaurants, you know.
There are, I think it was a hard explanation.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is, Michelin is here in the D.C. market because of Patrick. He's been really lobbying for them to come down and be in this area. So he's been a huge advocate for the D.C. dining scene, even though he's 90 minutes away.
Mm-hmm.
And that third star on his 40th year was, you know, incredibly important to him. Let's talk about the Bib Gourmand this year, because there are 19 new additions. What are you most excited about?
Let's see. Where have I made reservations already?
Okay, tell us where you're eating.
Supra, Succotash.
Have you been to Supra?
No. So anywhere that I went to while I was doing Mission Michelin, I'm not going to go. I'm going to consider I've, you know, been to, quote unquote.
Yes.
So of the 19 new ones, there's 12 that I haven't been to.
Mm-hmm.
So Supra and Succotash.
So Supra is a Georgian restaurant, which may sound odd to some people, but it's a beautiful restaurant. They're serving authentic Georgian cuisine. I know this is going to sound crazy. Get the sparkling water. The sparkling water they serve there is the Georgian biggest export.
Cool.
And it's delicious. It's a super salty water.
Ooh.
I'm obsessed with it.
I have a SodaStream in my office and my house. I drink like 9,000
gallons. Okay, you're
going
to love the sparkling water. I'm interested to hear your thoughts on Succotash. I'm very surprised by Succotash.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I will let you know.
Okay.
The other one, I never know how to say it. Is it Kaliwa? That's the other one.
Oh, Kaliwa, yes.
Yes, yes.
Cahal Armstrong's new restaurant. It's very exciting. I'm thrilled for him.
Me too. So those are the ones, I'm looking through the list. Yeah, those are the ones where I have reservations, like the minute it came out, I was like, all right,
okay, so now we'll do this. So you want to be an ambassador? I think that's an amazing idea. Tonight, are you going to say to Michael Ellis, I'm your ambassador? Like, you should come in with like a Michelin like sash on you that sort of says what you want to do. Like, how do you think you'll be able to affect your goal?
That's a great question. I think continuing to be kind of in the Michelin world will be the first step. So, for instance, I went to the 6 Michelin star, which I guess is really 7 Michelin star dinner last night at Pineapple and Pearls with Pineapple and Pearls mini bar and the Inn at Little Washington. Going to the gala tonight. I'm going to the Smithsonian event on Friday, where Michael's going to be talking about the history of the Michelin Guide. I'm hopefully going to the New York release as well. So I hope they just keep playing within the Michelin world.
Right. You're just going to stalk them until you
basically
get what you want.
Yeah,
I think it's a really smart idea. The last question I'm going to ask you is really, dining this much is not cheap. So I think a lot of people are going to be like, yeah, I mean, clearly this woman has tons of money because she just, you know, goes out all the time. How are you able, like, how are you able to do it?
I think that, I mean, financially, it's a combination of going to lunch and dinner. I will say the thing that's been hardest for me has not been money. It's been time. I actually have two little kids. I'm married. So I had to create like a very strict schedule about what days I go out.
Well, you're
out.
A statistician, right?
Yes, that's exactly. What you do. I'm very OCD about everything. Okay. So everything was kind of regimented and finding the time to do it. Sometimes bringing my kids, you know, only going out so many nights a week. That's been much harder for me, I would say, budgeting the time.
Okay. Well, I think that totally makes sense. I mean, going out and dining out is... it doesn't have to be a sport. You've made it into one. I think bringing your kids is a priority as well. And Michael Ellis made note of that, that not all of these restaurants are fine dining, fancy restaurants where you can't bring children. And I'm thinking more and more places want children at the restaurants because families will come and dine there.
Well, and what's adorable is when I went to both Inn at Little Washington and the last time I went to Minibar, my poor daughter, who's five, came out in her dress and she's like, all right, I'm ready to go.
Aww.
And I was like, aw, Ave, hold on. We're almost ready for a tasting menu.
Not just yet.
Yeah.
Not just yet. Well, so where can people find you?
So I am at Mission Michelin on Instagram and on Twitter and missionmichelin.com.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
I think it's so fascinating what you're doing and I hope you can... reach your goals. I think it would be in their best interest to bring you on board since you can't be a judge because you're not a secret and everybody knows who you are in the DC market. And I want to thank everybody for joining me today. This was so much fun talking about the Michelin Guide. There's a huge gala this evening where they'll be anointing the stars to all the star chefs. The Bib Gourmand dropped last week. Of course, you can find all this information on my website, thelistareyouonit.com. It is all up there. And I want to thank Michael Ellis, even though he's not here, for joining us today and talking about the Michelin Guide, and Kylie as well. Next week, we have such an amazing show. Scott Trouneau and Danny Lee, the Chico guys, are going to be in studio. They're opening up another Chico here. They're also opening up one in San Diego. They're going national. And they've got a new concept called Anju, which is like a Korean tapas or like late night bar place. I've been to their pop-up of it. It is so delicious and so much fun. And they're going to give us all the goods on it next week. So I want to thank you all for joining me today. I'm Nikki Nellis. This is Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast at the fabulous Line Hotel. Have a delicious week.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at @FullServiceRDO. On Instagram and Facebook at Full Service Radio. Thanks for listening.